I was, yeah, it was, I work off of two major systems of analysis that have been my orientation.
As a
One is called,
chiropractor.
yeah, one is called sacro-occipital technique, as taught by a guy named Major D. Jarnett, who was an osteopath and an engineer as well as a chiropractor. And he taught, cranial work and all kinds of different aspects to the chiropractic profession, which included organ reflexes and cranial work and extremities and,
And acupressure.
all kinds of different things with it. And then network spinal is another system of analysis, which also includes a lot of the multiple layers of energy that are also involved in the mind-body system.
How do you access those layers?
Training.
No, she's, come
I'm
on.
not sure how to answer that.
He
I'm not
answers
sure.
in very general.
I'm not
He
sure
does
that.
know the answer. I trust me. He knows the answer. Jim, she's asking you a technical question.
Are you asking a technical question?
Sure. How do you do you access it with a tuning fork, with
No,
intuition, with vision?
the answer is yes with whatever tools you use, but the bottom line is it's person to person in whatever tools you use. But
She's
it's
looking.
just sensitive, being sensitive to, it's hands-on, effectively. I think that's the most important thing. One can use those other tools, but those are just adjuncts to having the sensitivity to be able to interact with that person on many levels, on many perspectives that simultaneously.
I just get impatient with chiropractors who only do the atlas or who only do the spine and nothing else. It just seems like, the thigh bones connect to the ankle bone. We're a system, like a hydraulic system, and to do work on one part seems short-sighted to me.
I certainly understand where they're coming from because it's an extremely important area because of the way the anatomy is. But I mean, my original orientation with chiropractic, I came from a medical background working in ICUs and emergency rooms. And, I didn't drink the Kool-Aid. In other words, the dogma part of that conversation, I didn't take to it at all, much too, I've seen too much to be able to take that and just run with it. Though I do understand the importance of that area, and I know a lot of those folks get incredible results because of the importance of that area. But I also know there's other avenues and there's other ways to look at it, which are incredibly important also. So I'm with you. It never. Well, I'll put it to you this way. One of my original guides, when I first got into school, Kitty said to me, "Oh yes, just do one technique." That was her, And so my first half of school, I came from upper cervical background chiropractically, and then learned about the SOT, which covered all kinds of different ways to look at it. So I was like happy as a camper because it was one technique. But it encompasses an incredible amount of way to look at it. So I was finally going, thank you, God, because the other way is just like, wait, this is like this, the other way. And I'd already seen the other parts. So
Got it. Well, let's
he's gesticulating with his glasses, and I'm afraid
And
that
she's shutting my
they're
arm
gonna
down
end up in
for
my eye. This is part of the, what it's like to be married for or living together for 40 years.
Okay, let's start at the beginning, for each of you. Where and when were you born?
We've got your questions.
Yeah, forget about them.
Okay. Do I go first?
No, you go first. She's interviewed me on another
Okay,
interview.
what was the first question?
Where when where and when were you born?
Are we doing a chart?
I'd like to know your astrological sign for sure.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Kansas City, Missouri, August 23rd, 1953. 0 degrees Virgo, 0 degrees, actually cusp. 0 degrees Leo Virgo, but it's actually Virgo. And it's a teacup kind of a configuration. Rising moon is Aquarius, and yeah.
What you have rising?
I think it's Aquarius.
And your moon is Aquarius too?
I think so. I think so. I had to go back and look.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. And then how did you get from Kansas City to New York, where you met Robin?
I never went to New York.
Oh, okay.
I don't know New York at all.
Okay.
No. Come on, he's teasing you. We did not meet.
My parents moved us from, we lived in Wichita, Kansas, and my parents moved us down to Miami, Florida, North Miami Beach, when I was 13, because of family and because of the political environment in Wichita at the time. So from 1967 to 1975, I lived in North Miami Beach or Miami area.
So it was really conservative and rednecky in Wichita? So,
yeah. Well, the story I got was my dad was part of the, among other things that he did, was part of the desegregation aspect at the time, and he was really a big pusher on busing, and he was getting, apparently what I heard was he was getting death threats.
Oh wow.
And I think that in conjunction with a lot of our family who are all from the Midwest, a lot of them were moving down to North Miami Beach or Miami area, his brothers and sisters. So he said, that's it, we're out of here, you know, we moved down there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a combination.
Got it. Robin, you were born in New York.
I was born in Philadelphia in 1952. So my birth date is April 26, 1952. I'm a Taurus with Scorpio rising. My Mars is in Scorpio. I forget some of the aspects of it. I do know that I have a big trine in my chart, and my midheaven is Leo, so there's a lot of power and stuff, you know, in the middle of my chart like that. So I have, you know, a lot of energy.
And the 10th house is occupation, so you've put a lot of energy into your career. So you're both earth signs. Do you think that helps understand each other?
I think astrology is so layered and so deep that I think that's a question that's, you know, there's too many interactions to answer that simply. It might, but I think there's a whole lot more there than in the soup.
Right.
You know.
In the spiritual soup.
Yeah.
I think he means.
So how did you get from Philadelphia to New York, Robin?
Yeah, so my dad was a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania. My mother was a freshman journalism student, and I was born there in the hospital, the university hospital, and then after 2 years, they moved. I guess my dad graduated, and they moved to New York, and he did his internship at Columbia Presbyterian. And so I lived until I was nine in Manhattan, and then we moved to Great Neck, Long Island. So we lived in Long Island. You know, I grew up in terms of my high school and everything. And then I ended up going to college at Fairleigh Dickinson University in 1970, and it was there that I came in contact with my English professor, a guy named Bruce Hoffman, who introduced me to Meher Baba. So when I was 18 and a freshman in college, I found out about Meher Baba, and this must have been in September 1970. And then as a result of that, I went down in April of 1971 to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where the spiritual center is. In the United States, there's a spiritual center. And so I went down. That was my first visit. And then in December of 71 was my first trip to India. So that's kind of the prelude, because Jim and I met initially. Yeah, we did. He doesn't remember. We don't remember each other. That's why he's saying no.
We actually were in the same area, Miami, and we knew a lot of the same people.
And went to the same meetings.
And we went to the same meetings, but we never actually met in Miami in 1972. It was not until 1975 in Myrtle Beach at
right.
Alan Wagner's Christmas party.
Right. Mara's birthday party.
But,
that's true.
But Robin, you remember Jim from Miami?
I have this image of who I think was Jim, but he's correct in the sense that we would go to the same meetings and knew the same people and lived in that area, but we didn't really know each other.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1975, you came to Myrtle Beach to spend the summer working at Beguine Ice Cream.
Mm-hmm. Being the manager of Beguine Ice Cream.
Mm-hmm. But you found out about Bob
in
Florida, in Miami. You found out about Meher Baba, so yeah. You might want to
That's
just call.
That's a great story, too, yeah.
Well, let's hear it.
when we moved to Miami, my parents moved us to an apartment building, the Presidential Apartments. And the very first friend I had is a guy named Benji Lieberman, lived down the hall kind of thing. Benji and I became good friends for a year or so. Three, four years. Anyway, he moved out. He graduated high school. He left. And then, a couple of years later, I mean, I lost contact with him, and he moved down to Coconut Grove, which was like 30 miles away from where we lived. One time I was down in Coconut Grove and something just shot in my head and said, geez, I got to see Benji. I know he lives down here somewhere, you know, out of the blue. And I got the connection. I found out where he was, went down to his place, and it just so happened that same moment, literally that day, that moment, a guy named Paul Newman, no, not the actor, another Paul Newman, walked in, was telling Benji about what's called the 69 Darshan, which happened in Pune, and this is 1970 now. He had just come back from India, and he was telling Benji and David Katz about it. And I just happened to be there, and that's the first I ever heard about Meher Baba. And I think that was the first time Benji heard about Baba also. Somehow I got something, you know, some pamphlet or something. And I was a senior in high school at that time. Promptly went home, put it in my desk drawer, didn't think about it much. After I graduated high school that year, that, you know, 6 months later, I ended up moving in and sharing a room with Benji down in that area, Coconut Grove. And so it was like the neat part was the person that I was supposed to meet to make that connection. It was the very first person I met in Miami. And when the time was supposed to happen, bam, it happened, you know. And then there's a whole string of things that happened afterwards that kind of sealed the deal, if you will. Regarding where I was going
right.
with Baba. But that was the initial connection, you know.
And it just so happened that the summer of 72, I went to Myrtle Beach and met a woman who was married to a guy. And they both lived in Miami. In Coral Gables, I think.
Yeah.
That was, oh gosh, you know, Ron Greenstein's first wife.
Oh, Ron,
Bobby Greenstein. Yeah. And so I was there kind of trying to figure out what to do that summer before I went to London. I was about to go to London for 2 years to do a drama college and conservatory there. So I moved in, I went down with her and I moved in with them, but I ended up renting a room in a house from a guy named Ronnie Lawn.
South Miami.
And so I lived there for the summer, and it just so happened that when I moved out of that house, guess who moved into that house?
Probably the same room. I don't know, but probably the same room.
It's like we knew all these people,
Ronnie,
but we kept missing each other.
Ronnie's dad was this multimillionaire real estate mogul. So Ronnie gets his house for free, you know, like a 3 or 4 bedroom house with a swimming pool. I mean, we're all 18, 19, 20 years old. I mean, this is like heaven, you know. And I moved in from I think I was in Brickell. I don't remember. Anyway, I ended up in the South Miami right after you left, literally a week later.
Right. You know? So we had all these intertwining things, people and places and all, but we didn't really connect or meet until we ended up in, then I came back from London and moved to New York. I moved back to New York to my parents' place, but I eventually ended up moving down to Myrtle Beach because that's where I wanted to be, and a lot of my friends had moved there from different places around the country, and it just so happened that Jim was spending the summer there in between. Was that right before you went to chiropractic?
That was, yeah, I was at Coastal Carolina getting prereq courses for my, well, that was a year later. That was later. No, I think I was still work. I was living in Durham working at the VA. And I was down visiting Myrtle Beach. I was in Myrtle Beach for a couple of weeks visiting. I think that's when we met in 75, because it was the following year that I spent the summer. I went into the chiropractic program in 77, so it was, you know, later.
So in 75, we met at this party.
Oh, that's going back.
Alan Wagner, who was a professional dancer from New York.
And we still have the tiger.
And he had a party, and and we danced together and kind of hung out together, met each other. And, you know, we liked each other. I really liked him. I really thought, you know, he was so in those days, when I was in my early 20s, I had, you know, guys that I hung out with as friends, and I had guys that I dated. And the guys that I dated usually were older. And the guys that I had as friends were like buddies. I really liked them. Ronnie said to me something about, well, Ronnie was there too, I think, guy that we had rented.
Oh, yeah, Ronnie had moved from Miami back with the Myrtle Beach. Same Ronnie that owned that house, now he's in Myrtle Beach.
Now in Myrtle
Beach.
He's
at the party.
He's at the party.
Introduces so each other.
He introduces us, I think. Anyway, he said to me,
whatever.
He said, you know, Jim is a really nice guy, but you can't dress him and take him anywhere.
He's a real schlump.
He's a real schlump.
He's right.
So that was kind of a funny thing. But we hit it off, and we were very good friends for a long time.
Yeah, I would come to Myrtle Beach on breaks when I was either living in Durham or living in Atlanta for the next 3-4 years until 1980. You know, as I was going to school, I went through the 4-year program, and you know, we'd run into each other at the Mayor Baba Center and sit and yak. You know, and during that 3-4 year period, she got married. I got married.
To each other.
No, my marriage didn't last. Her marriage didn't last. You know, we went through all this stuff.
We didn't have kids in those marriages.
We just hung out when I'd visit and you know, run into each other. It wasn't anything planned or anything at that point, you know?
Yeah.
So you didn't think, oh, this person I could really see as a partner. It was just like you were friends, casual, no big revelations of this is my life partner.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well,
not at that point.
But I don't think it was casual. I mean, I think it was somebody who, like, I always, Jim had a yellow VW bug, and whenever I would see the yellow VW bug parked there, you know, and I knew he was there, I got really excited. I would always be really excited to see him, and we spent a lot of time together when we were both in the same place.
We sit there and hang out in the refectory.
I mean, for hours.
Sit there and yeah.
For hours. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, now here's the crazy thing. I actually got married in 1976 to a guy who was about 13 years older than I and really should have been a mentor. He was really more of a mentor type, but I think it was a karmic thing, like a karmic
completion.
And like I owed him a karmic debt, I feel like. But anyway, I was very close. That was another reason maybe that, you know, I got together with him. But he was much older than I was, but he was a mentor in some ways, many ways. But so I was already married. I was married, and then one day Jim shows up, and I don't remember what year it was, but I was sitting, we were, you know, Meher Baba, Baba's house on Sunday is a place where, you know, the community would come and go and kind of meditate and, you know, hang out and everything. So I was there, and he came in with this woman, and he said, oh, I want you to meet my wife. And I know I wasn't supposed to have any kind of feeling about that, but just intuitively, it really hit me in the gut. You know?
She was married.
I was married. Like, and I thought, what's going on here? Why am I having this reaction? You know, it's like as if I was married to him and he was having an affair or something. You know, I was so weird, the reaction that I had, and so strong, you know. And I didn't tell him about that. I didn't tell him at that point in time.
Because he was married, yeah.
You know, I noticed that I had that. I'm pretty self-aware, and I noticed, you know, that I had that reaction.
And your relationship had always been platonic up to that point.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay, then how did things change?
Well,
I don't know. What the hell happened?
I tricked you into it.
Yeah.
No.
Let's see. I know that when I graduated, I went up to New England for a residency. And I remember you telling me later that it felt like you got hit in the gut and that, you know, it was like, to me, it was like, you know, why? But you had come over before I graduated, a graduate program.
Well, it was complicated.
Yeah.
I was working as a alcohol and drug counselor for the Horry County Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, and I graduate school. And all of my mentors that were really cool and I really liked them and I loved the work they were doing and I wanted to emulate them, they all had masters of social work degrees. They were clinical social workers. So I applied to two programs, the University of South Carolina
in Columbia
and the University of Georgia in Athens. And you were last year at Life.
About an hour and a half drive.
Right. And so when I had an interview, I asked Jim if I could come over and stay with him. And then I drove up to, so I came over And I stayed over with him, and then I drove up to Athens and had my interview and then came back.
I remember that night. We spent till like 4 in the morning.
Wait, you weren't married. Neither of you were married at that point.
Well, no, I was married.
You were married, but you were like in the
I was in the process.
Process of separating. She had made a decision saying, this is the way she told me, was that she told her husband, like, I want to go get this degree, and you either come with me or not. And basically said, that's it, you know, enough. And he basically said, no.
Well, that was, sort of. I mean, it was sort of like that. Well, what it was I was actually the person in the relationship that was making money and supporting us. And I said to him at that point, I'm going to go to graduate school. My grandfather is going to give me, I'm not going to work. I'm quitting my job. I'm going to go to graduate school, sorry. And my grandfather is going to, pay the tuition. I said, you can come with me, but you have to support us mentally. And he declined to do that. So that was it for me. I mean, I really knew that was not the person. I needed to be with someone who was also a professional person like I was, and who was going to, be responsible and make money. And I mean, that wasn't the most important thing, but but that was kind of the tip of the iceberg of the problems that we had in that relationship. And so we were separating, we were legally separated. And, but when I came, I didn't come as a girlfriend or anything. I came as a friend, but we spent a lot of time together.
I had just spent, God, I'm having these memories. I had just spent the last 3 months, I think, going through what my big brother would call a super date. And I said, there was nothing super about it. It's basically, I got married and it turned out to be hell. And I had been forewarned by Charmy to not get
she
married.
She doesn't know who these people are.
But there's all these parts.
Charmy and Knowles, Knowles,
Deuce Knowles.
Ivy Deuce's daughter, and Ivy Deuce was the Murshida of Sufism reorient.
Anyway, so I was on the way. What happened was I did my almost year's worth of residency in New England, and moved back to Myrtle Beach, and it took me about a week in Myrtle Beach to say, there's no way I'm going to make a living in Myrtle Beach doing what I want to do. So where would be the next closest place? And I went to Florence and worked with Don Jones for a few months, and I realized that that's not where I want to spend my life, in Florence, South Carolina. Yes, you would come over. We started talking, and then she moved to Columbia for school?
For school, yeah.
And I moved to Columbia the same month, and it was just like from then on we were inseparable. We just ended up in the same town at the same time, and we started hanging together.
And that was it.
And we were inseparable. We just that was it.
Well, we didn't live in the same place, but for a while.
In fact, I remember
Don.
We were, I don't know if you were clueless, but I know I was clueless that one day we were at Don's office and he looked at us and he went, and I'm like, what, are we that obvious? And he went, toward each other, And I'm like, oh, I guess he's right,
We were younger and thinner, dear.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we actually were,
So why did you, just to finish with your first marriage, Jim, why did you marry her if it was a disaster, and what made you have the incentive to leave?
That's a pretty easy question.
Good.
I had gone out to San Francisco with the intention of maybe trying to join the Sufis. And Marcia just said, well, dear, when you get done with school, you can talk to us again, and, you know, whatever. I ended up having dinner with her daughter, Charmian. And Charmian, which I did not know at the time, happened to have been very psychic, and I didn't know this. And as I was leaving, she literally said two things to me, totally out of the blue, that I was like going, okay. She said, don't get married till after you graduate school. And I'm like, okay. She goes, do you know why we have droughts? And I'm like, no. Yeah, and she went through this whole thing. I went, okay, you know. And that summer we had one of the worst droughts on record in Atlanta, and people were absolutely blown out, freaking out. And I was like going, oh, that's why Charmy told me all that. Oh, okay, no big deal. You know, no deal. And I met somebody within a couple of months after having dinner with her at a seminar, a professional seminar. And this lady was just graduating another chiropractic school. Anyway, we hit it off fabulously, and we both made the mistake of, like, connecting the dots and got married. Well, it turned out that she was pregnant from her previous boyfriend, which I did not know, and she got an abortion for that. Which I wasn't really happy about, but it was not a deal buster at that point. But what the deal buster was, we went on our honeymoon. We were on a,
cruise.
We were on one of those
ships.
100-foot.
Cruise liner.
Yeah, not the big cruisers, but the small ones. I can't think of the name of it, out in the Caribbean. Anyway, I think it was the second night we were out. I decided to go down to the cabin and kind of, you know, crap out. She said, well, I'm going to stay up here for a little while. I said, okay. I woke up an hour later out of the blue and just had a feeling to go up on deck. And here she is cuddling with some guy on the deck, you know, all wrapped up. And I'm like, that was it. That was pretty much it. That was our honeymoon. So that was a pretty uncomfortable cruise after that.
I bet.
And when we got back, you know, the papers started being served immediately. And it took about 6 months to get all the stuff done. But, you know, that was a biggie.
What did you learn from that? So you learned not to go with what seems logical, connects the dot, to pay attention to the deeper stuff?
What I learned first was listen to Charmian. You know, but it was like, don't get carried away by your emotions. You know, take your time. I know the Sufis do this with their couples, that they insist on having at least 1 year, possibly two, of
friendship.
You know, friendship, chaperoned kind of stuff, you know, very old school, and for damn good reason, you know. So, that was a big lesson. But I guess that was a karmic thing too, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are several lessons with that.
Right.
You know.
But the good news is for anybody who is interested in this is that this.
Oh, I know her
the
now.
Woman. Is she's a chiropractor, and her office is a several miles from where we live.
Oh, it's like 3-minute drive.
And yeah. You know, we're not friends, buddy friends, but we're all friends. I mean, it's not. There's
no animosity.
Yeah, know, I mean, there like probably that. Was early on. You must have had that on.
Yeah,
but not now.
But you know, I didn't blame her. I just saw that she was incredibly. What's the word? You know, confused with all whatever was going on. And I really blamed myself because, I mean, Charmy told me, don't do this, you know? And I went ahead and did it. So I didn't have anybody to blame but myself.
Yeah, but you didn't go to her as a psychic.
No,
so
I didn't.
You weren't
I didn't go to her for that. It was just, she just said it, you know?
Yeah.
So I just, you know, that was the lesson I took away. It was just, you know, pay attention to that stuff and don't get carried away and be, use your discretion, you know?
Yeah. And how important intuition is. And
So Meyer Baba is on the, is the picture behind you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. All over.
The
picture that you can see behind us.
Yeah. What would he say about what makes a marriage work? I mean, what have you learned in terms of the spiritual approach?
Well, first thing that just popped in my head.
Oh, is the
sandpaper.
But the discourses. Meher Baba had a whole discourse.
Actually, I thought of this. Yeah, I thought of this just before we got on. Was, you know, when the question would come up, I would recommend, like, the question you had here is, what would you?
What advice would you give to newlyweds?
Yeah. What advice? And what came to my consciousness was, read the damn discourses. Read the discourses. Read Baba's discourses on marriage. Because there's so much incredible information and proper
attitude.
Perception of things, you know, on a very deep, very profound level with those discourses, and they're a great guide, you know.
So what's something that really stuck with you that you thought, oh, this is something I really have to pay attention to that Baba said in terms of being a good husband?
I think the depth of the connection and the depth of commitment that you have to not just come in with, but to continually have. And the reason why I say that, I was doing the sandpaper thing here, in the discourses, he talks about that if you have the proper attitude, that the marriage itself can deliver you almost to the doorstep of enlightenment. And it can carry you to the point where, you know, all it takes is a touch of the master. I mean, you can get the life lessons if you do it with the proper attitude through the marriage, just like any other life path. Having said that, it all sounds very wonderful, but it can be a knockdown, drag out, takes everything you got to stick with it rather than run like hell, because you're gonna get confronted at some point with all kinds of things that you had never even dreamed of, you know, during this process. This isn't, I would rearrange the thinking and say, you know, what does that soul need to traverse this life to get the most good, to get closest to the goal? Well, depending on the person's karma, it just may happen to be they get married this time versus some other time. Whatever lessons they need to learn, the marriage is the vehicle that they need to do. So the real challenge, I think, is not only getting married, but sticking to it. Because I think the couple, that the people are going to change over that period of time, I think. I mean, I know we have. Mm-hmm. I'm coming from that, you know, that picture. And to be able to keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper into areas that sometimes are not pleasant at all. And that takes you well past any romantic fantasies you may have. It's going to take you to some pretty dark places, and you got to work through them. But the reward is the depth of the soul, of the wisdom and the love that comes out of that. But it's like, I think Mershida talks about, you know, if you want to join Sufism, you got to feel so much like if you don't do this, you're going to die. Like, you got to feel like it's not even a choice, that you absolutely have to do it. You have to have that kind of energy
to
be able to get through some of the toughest part. Because otherwise, you're going to run.
Robin, you know, what did you take from
at some point.
What did you take from the discourses that you could apply to your marriage?
Yeah, and it goes beyond the discourses because we not only, you know, have read the discourses, which actually Meher Baba wrote for the future, you know, generations. And the reason I say that is that it's kind of a book for the masses. But we came to Baba right at the time when he left his physical body. And the first 100 years, you know, within that period, you know, and the first 50 years, which is just come up on an end of, you still had all of the disciples, you know, that lived with him and that followed him. So, for example, if you wanted to put it into a framework that other people can understand, let's say, you know, when Jesus was in the physical body and his disciples and then Mary Magdalene and his mother and the women, there were a bunch of women disciples as well. So you had male disciples and women disciples. And then let's say Jesus leaves his physical body, and then you have these 50 years with the disciples. That's what it was like for us, because we came as teenagers or late teen, early 20s, and then we knew most of those people.
We met them.
Yeah. Well, more than met.
Yeah.
You know, in different places that I lived, you know, we were very, you know, different places around the world that we lived, we were in very close contact. When he says Kitty, he's talking about Kitty Davy, who was one of Meher Baba's very close disciples from England, who then lived in India with him and then came to Myrtle Beach to establish the Myrtle Beach Center with Elizabeth Patterson,
who and
Narina Machiavelli, Princess Narina Machiavelli. So, and we knew these people. It wasn't like we knew them and they guided us. Well, you know, the last 10 years of Elizabeth's life, and then Kitty lived till 100. So we had 20 years with her. So anyway, just to say that it's not just what I read in the discourses, it's what we were trained to do. So I think what's really important is to understand, you know, Meher Baba talked about different levels of love, and you can find that in writings, spiritual writings, you know, from any source. One level of love is, you know, the lust level. And another level is a deeper level, you know, and then you get to agape, which is this, you know, love for humanity and the world and all of that. So in the beginning of a relationship, you know, it's very much that, you know, you're attracted by love. Love is attraction. I mean, even as Meher Baba says in the Discourse on Love, is even the lion that eats the deer, the attraction there is love. It's a lower level of love, but it's love. So we, you know, initially you're attracted to, you know, the person. You have no idea what your past life connections are. You have no idea what your karmic connections are, but somehow you feel drawn. And of course, you know, part of that being drawn is a sexual, romantic kind of a thing. But that only lasts, you know, during the honeymoon period. You know, it lasts a certain amount, and then you are confronted with, and then over time, years, you have so many connections on so many levels, so many chords energetic little ropes and nets and, you know, things that intertwine you that if you were to cut them and sever them, like if he were to die, I mean, or we were to divorce or whatever, it's very traumatic. It's very traumatic because you're cutting all the energetic cords all at once, you know. So the love changes. And I think what Jim's talking about, you know, that it can get very dark you have to address your shadow self. It's your, whatever comes out in the marriage is just a reflection of what's going on inside the individual. So it's a great way to work on your ego. And people run at that point. They look at the other person and they blame the other person, but really it's really what's going on in them. And then if you, it's like the dark night of the soul, you know, in mystical terms.
It's not all like that.
No.
We're not here to not, you know.
No. But no, I mean, you have to have a good sense of humor you have to have fun to, you know, fun and stuff together. But there's that aspect there, and it's a commitment. it's a spiritual journey, and it's a commitment. And it's very easy in our culture to not follow through with that commitment. You know, people very easily, I mean, I'm a therapist, and I can tell you that, you know, people come in, it's all too easy to get married. It's all too easy to get divorced. I mean, you know, and people are not in it. They start blaming the other person. And so it's I think, you know, what maybe Herbaba explains is if you have the right attitude and the right perception of what it is, then it's a partnership. And you go through that part, you go through it together. And there are times when, for example, you know, when Jim was sick and, you know, I have to take care of him, or when I was having babies and he essentially had to take care of me at certain times. And, you know, it's never a 50-50. Sometimes it is, but most of the time,
you won't even know,
you know, at that point, but it switches back and forth. Because sometimes you're giving more, and sometimes you're giving, you're receiving.
There's a incident that comes to mind. Somebody asked Baba, you know, what's the perfect marriage, you know? And he pointed to Sarosh and Velu, who was their close disciples of Baba's, and pointed to them, and you go, but Baba, they're always bickering. He says, yeah, sandpaper.
So wearing
each other's egos down, you know.
Where have been those sandpaper issues for you two? Where have you had conflicts? For some people, it's having babies. The kids are the biggest source of conflict. For some people, it's money. Where would you be sandpapered?
My first reaction is just pick one.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
No.
I don't know.
I think those are all hot spots. I mean, as I said, as a therapist, I know that, you know, it may not be true 100% in our relationship, you know, but the issues, you know, that most people fight about are things like children and money and religion and politics.
Housework. You know, who does the family work? In-laws.
That's not such a
I don't know. In-laws, we got lucky.
Yeah.
Both of our parents were nice to each other and nice to us and didn't give us a hard time.
Yeah.
Even though my parents didn't like Kent.
Well, now that's my stepfather.
But they still all, you know, they.
Yeah.
We all, you know, part of that's just attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, in-laws is not bad,
So what's been your main? What's been the most difficult, challenging issue? Most sandpaper.
Over
time, things change. Mm-hmm. And what might be the most difficult thing may not be, well, it may not, the sandpaper part may not come out that way, but it may be difficult.
Well, I think in the beginning of our marriage, you know, Jim was starting a practice, a chiropractic practice. At that point, he wasn't teaching. He was actually, you know, had an office. And he was new right out of chiropractic college and not all that great with money, and didn't know how to run a practice, and had a lot of anxiety about it. And I was in graduate school, so I could help him, you know. But I also had my own things and everything. So that was you know, negotiating all of that, getting all of that, you know. So money was involved. just getting an office up and running and dealing with his anxiety and, you know, my graduate school all. And then we went into a period of, you know, after I got out of graduate school, then I started having babies. And
I want to interrupt. She said something that's really important. She said the word negotiate. And to me, what I think of is we have had all kinds of different issues over the years, right? But we've always, for the most part, we've always had the attitude of respecting and listening to our partner.
Yeah.
And valuing, you know, not devaluing or putting them down, but giving them space to be who they were. And just to say, you know, and be able to talk to each other. You know, we not always like what they said, but you know, we didn't yeah. You know.
And right. And not only their intellect, but also their intuition. and really like if Jim said to me, I really have a strong feeling about this, about something, you know, I totally respect his intuition and vice versa. And we have a funny little story that when we were
several.
Yeah, but the one where we were living in Rockport, Massachusetts. Our son Josh was like 9 or 10 months old.
Yeah.
You know, and we went out on a date.
We drove the 40 miles to Boston.
To Boston.
We were living in Rockport.
And we had a little babysitter. And then towards the end of the night, Jim said...
Well, we were driving back, and I was on Route 128. We were and going 55 miles an hour on that road is not a good thing to do. I'm going 70, 80 miles an hour on this thing, and I'm going, what the hell am I doing? And Robin's going, why are you driving so fast? And I'm going, I don't know, but something's telling me, just driving me to do this. I'm doing it. You know, so we did it, and we got home. And I literally raced into the house, and the babysitter was asleep in front of the TV.
On the couch.
And I go racing to the stairs, which were these old, this is a 200-year-old house, this old captain's stairs that are very steep and they're wood, right? And I race to the stairway, and I look up, and there's Josh asleep, about to make the first step down the steps. And I raced up and grabbed him.
Wow.
That was like there was an angel, you know. Go, 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 go.
Well, it's good you listened to your guidance. That was brilliant.
But I was laughing because when you said about it, she said about intuition, the first thing came to me. We have a house in India, and she was over there visiting. And I don't know how many times we've been to India, but every time we go, Rob would go, hey, let's go look at the land. Let's go look at the condos or this or that. And I'm like, all right, you know, whatever. You know, just make her happy. And so, you know, it wasn't surprising to me that she's going through this again, though I'm over here now, that particular trip.
So I
get this phone call, or this is Skype or whatever the heck it was. You're going to think I'm crazy. I'm like, yeah, what else is new? I'm standing on this hill with Melinda,
right?
And I'm looking out over the landscape, over the vista, and it reminds me so much of our house in Cape Cod.
Our family.
I can't tell you how much I feel so strongly about this. It's such a strong intuition. Do you think I should go ahead and make an offer? And the way she said it was that classic case where what came through was I just got that hit. She had that intuitive hit. It happened. Otherwise, I would have said, you're out of your freaking mind. It's like, are you kidding? It's okay to go play, but please don't do that. But that's not what happened. It was like something told me in the tone and the way she did it. However, we know.
Jim, please. He's going to hit me in the eye. I know he is. Poor Gail.
No, I'm fine.
know each other's signals. The radar is on. Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, it's like, do what you got to do. Just follow it and see where it takes you. So you know, that's the attitude.
You've raised four boys. So that that must...
Four.
What?
Four boys. She's not getting it.
No.
I got 10 fingers.
Four boys.
Okay. What's been the impact of raising four boys on the marriage?
Well, it depends on which one.
What's the impact of having
insanity?
Kids?
Insanity.
I don't know. It's like before Christ and after Christ. It's a whole other different ballgame. You know, a new soul comes into the picture. It's a whole other ballgame, a whole other level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know how to answer that. Yes.
What about birth order? Like the firstborn tends to be the achiever, and the middle child maybe gets a little left out, and the third child acts out their own path. It's different than the first. I mean, are there, how would you characterize the personalities of the boys?
Well, Josh is our oldest, and he just turned 37. In fact, we just celebrated his birthday, and he's definitely the commander in chief. You know, he's definitely the maverick.
Who used to be the wildest pain in the you know what you could possibly imagine.
He was,
and now he's Mr. Conservative.
Yeah,
and commander in chief. You know,
when did he switch?
I don't know. I think he hit bottom at some point, and then he found structure.
Well, yeah, he was going into that direction. But I think, you know, he has three children now. So he's now a father, and, he sees himself as a father and a provider. And, you know, they live next door. They bought the house next door. This is the kid who, when he was 4 years old, he said to us, Mommy, Mommy. Daddy, Daddy, I'm going to live with you forever.
He did.
Yeah, he did. We looked at each other and went, oh, no. And we thought he was kidding.
Then he bought the house next door without telling us.
Yeah, yeah.
Just came in one day and said, hey, guess what?
Oh, yeah.
I bought the house next door. Ha-ha, funny. No, really.
And then Johnny, who is the next one, and for a long time he was the middle child. He's the peacemaker. He's the easygoing. But he somatizes. He holds a lot of things in. So when he was little, he would have stomach aches.
And his mannerism. Everybody wants him as their kid.
Yeah.
Everybody wants Johnny as their...
He has such delicious energy. Yeah. He really has delicious...
And he reminds me of my dad very much in the personality. Very mellow.
He was born on my birthday.
Very, very seemingly laid back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you say. And,
he was the Buddha kid. He was just smiling. He was very calm. Josh had a lot of... energy, you know, he hardly
Josh
slept.
Came out that way.
He came out that way. He looked like little Dr. Spock with his fingers like this.
My first impression of him, they bring him out and they hold him up like this, and Josh is going, right? And that's pretty much, you know, that's his gig.
Number three is Andrew, and he lives in New York. He's the one who has long-haul COVID. He's the one who is in theater and film and production and all. He's very, very bright. I mean, extraordinarily bright. When he was five, I took him to see Daniel and the Giant Peach. And I was putting him to bed at night, and he was laying in his bed, and he was thinking and thinking. And I said, Andrew, what's wrong? You know, why aren't you going to sleep? He said, I'm thinking that if I were the director of that movie, how I would have made it. He's like five.
Wow.
So, yeah. But he's also very disorganized. He has trouble with organization. So he struggles. He's struggling in New York. But he was the first of all the kids who actually moved out and went to college in New York. He left home. And
also, what just reminding, thinking mm-hmm. of, that our oldest one is very, very analytical. He's borderline genius in an analytical kind of way. And he takes that from my dad, was very smart that way, statistical analysis.
And Bill, your brother.
And my big brother, who's also a prodigy in that. I don't know what happened to me. but they all, like, Josh has that talent, and he's brilliant. And he's a software engineer, and he's brilliant at it.
Yeah.
Jonathan, our number two, easygoing guy, he's into photography, very creative. Very creative. And then number three, Andrew, has got his own talent, is very smart that way.
He's very talented. He's, you know, I worry more about Andrew than I do the other two, because he's very disorganized, and he hasn't quite gotten the hang of life in the same way.
You think he has ADD?
Oh, yeah, he definitely, yeah, when he was very young, he was diagnosed with ADHD, and he's probably the most wiggly, distractible kid, you know, that we had contact with, that we knew.
He probably got that from me.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting because when we were getting Andrew tested, we had to fill out checklists, and Jim would say, "Oh, I have that," you know. But when you were younger, they didn't.
No.
There was nobody diagnosed anybody with, and we don't do drugs, you know. We don't do allopathic medication, so you know he has to learn other ways. You know, that's where the HemiSync and what's the thing that you listen to, is that HemiSync?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, learning other ways of dealing with that. And then
I got a story before you go to
okay. this.
So when the kids were young, we had a pediatrician. What was his name?
Joel Sussman.
Okay. In Columbia. And Joel's a pediatrician for a long time. And then a couple of years go by, we hadn't seen him. And we end up taking Andrew to him, because he had turned into an ADD specialist, ADHD specialist. That's, you know, what he got into. So I'm sitting in his office one day. I said, "So Joel, what made you switch over to do just this?" He says, you don't understand. I am so ADHD, I have to have a nurse following me. And every room I go into, she's got to tell me who it is and why I'm going in there, you know, this kind of thing. He says, "Now I want to show you." He had these pictures, these photos in his office. He's got this one photo of his graduation class at University of Vermont Medical School, and it's a whole room full.
You know, or maybe a 500 or 1,000.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know,
students,
and he's up on the top row, and every single person is laser focused on the podium, right? Everybody's face is like this, right? There's one guy sitting in the top row
looking out the window.
No, looking out the window. Like
yeah.
That. Says, "You see that photo?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "That's me right up there."
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyhow.
So how did you get number four?
I mean,
okay.
Christopher.
Yeah, so Chris is my biological nephew, and we adopted him. I was 48. Jim was 46 or 47 when we adopted him.
That late?
Yeah.
Were that old?
Yeah, we were that old.
Holy
what was what happened to his biological mom?
Well, my sister is schizophrenic. She's schizoaffective bipolar type. And she had babies by different people in different situations, and she never could keep them. So he was the youngest of three, and by the time they needed to place him, we were in a position at that point where we could take him. So we asked the kids, how do you feel about this? And Andrew, who was nine at the time, and he was the baby of our three, I said, Mom, oh, we have to take him. I said, why? He said, because it's the right thing to do.
Oh.
So all the boys agreed, you know, to have him join our family. And so we adopted him. And so he's, you know, grown up with us. So he still lives with us.
He's 22 now.
22.
Yeah.
And he's on the spectrum?
Yep. But don't say that too loud. He's in the other room. He doesn't like to.
And he has radar.
He has definitely radar hearing.
Can he go to school and do stuff?
Well, we did get him through high school. He went to a very, in the later years of high school, he went to a small private school where he got, you know, one-on-one or one-on-two or, you know, attention. And he did graduate. So, and he works at a car wash. And he's a great worker. He's a great worker. And he's also very, very smart about certain things. You know.
You'd call it very high functioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does he plan on moving out or he likes it there?
I don't know, but I would like to see that at some point, you know. I'm 67, you're 69?
No.
68?
68? Yes, I'm 68. And how old are you, dear?
67?
So, yeah.
How did you organize with both of you working and having four kids? How did you do the roommate issues of cooking and cleaning and washing clothes and all that stuff?
Well, that too has changed a lot over time, because there was times when, you know, a lot of when the kids were young, where Jim was working full time and I was working, I was helping him in the office, but I was working part time. I was seeing clients either in our home or at the office or whatever, in between, you know, nursing and doing. So I was mostly in the mom role for when they were young. But, of course, I hate house cleaning. And so I would hire, when I could, definitely, somebody to come in. So we always, you know,
we both grew up in families that had housekeepers and we both hate house cleaning. So if we don't have a housekeeper, it's a problem.
Well, you know, and obviously there are times when we couldn't afford, you know, a lot, but, yeah. What I figured was that if I could pay somebody, you know, $10 or $20 an hour to clean my house for 2-3 hours, I was making more than that seeing a client in an hour.
Yes.
So it was not actually worth my while, you know, but we have every 2 weeks some, you know, people come in and do a thorough cleaning. But the daily stuff, you know, we've always coordinated.
Over the years, yeah, it depends on what was going on. We always coordinate. I don't remember.
Jim
ever.
Irons. I don't iron.
I don't iron.
But you used to.
I do iron, yeah.
He does.
I mean, you know, it depends on the situation.
Laundry.
Yeah, for right now, at this point in the game, yeah. It's easier for me to do the laundry. It's just, you know, the routines are just, I don't know, it feels kind of natural in a sense that we've both done so many roles over the years that it's just not an issue. You know, one of the questions was about
gender roles.
It's like that was left behind a long time ago. I mean, if we were going to get pissed off and upset about that one, you know,
well,
no hope.
Well, and we did
over the years we've both done pretty much everything, you know.
We did in different periods of our life. You know, there were times when, you know, we would do different things, but we always kind of divided it into what we were good at. So if Jim was good at something, you know, he would do that thing. For example, if you know, buying a car, let's say, he loves to research, you know, all the little minutia about buying a car and all that kind of stuff. Great, because that's not me, you know. But on the other hand, you know, finding a medical provider or finding a this or finding a that, you know, a lot of times, depending on what it is, if it's a chiropractor, no. But, you know, I usually did it. Or what are some other things that
cooking, it seems like it's the most important to people. So you both do it?
Yeah.
Do you plan it out, or it's just like, oh, I feel like it tonight, or I'm busy, or is it casual?
Yes.
Well, when the kids were little, it was more formal. He would go to the office and I would be home. And so I was, you know, baking bread and making soup and doing all this stuff. And then as they got older and I was working more hours and we were both out of the house, then it was, you know, okay, what are we going to do? You know, that wonderful, you know, what do we put in the crock pot? You know, or what are we going to do? And now it's, you know, there's certain things that we eat or whatever, you know, we just kind of together.
She'll go, what do you want to have tonight? I go, I don't care, whatever you want.
You know, you know, well, who will make the vegetables? Who's going to make that? You know. Like today I cooked chicken breasts and sweet potatoes, and then, you know, he cooked vegetables, and, you know, we had that for dinner, and, you know, different things. Last night we had the kids over. And the three grandkids, and you know, we just coordinated. So yeah, I mean, sometimes I come home and, like, when you got into, he goes through periods. So he went through periods of making wonderful chicken soup. Yeah, do you remember that? Yeah. You were making lentil soup and chicken soup and
How do you keep romance and sexual interest over four boys and decades? How does one keep it interesting?
That's kind of dysfunctional right now.
Yeah.
Now that we need to work on.
We're working on that. I think it goes through, you know, different cycles and particularly in aging too. So when high blood pressure, you know, causes some issues, and postmenopause causes issues and things like that. So we're working on it. The good thing about us, I feel like, is that we communicate, even if it's, you know, I'm really pissed off about this, or I'm really frustrated about that. We do communicate, and we do make it, you know, keep it light, make each other laugh. So if it gets too intense, we can always make light of it, or make each other laugh. So that's good. But we were talking about this, about how we were going to answer this question. I think it was yesterday or Friday. I can't remember. And we got into a whole thing about, what was it? It was like, we looked at it, the question, and we said romance and fun. He said, "Well, what did you say?" You said,
"No, you go." You went, romance. You know, like there's no romance, and I went, "Yeah, fun."
I said, "Well, you're
not getting fun unless you get the romance," and I'm going, "You're not getting romance unless you get the fun going."
Yeah.
So we need to work on that one. I don't think we're having a drought on romance and fun right now.
Well, over the years, what's been fun? I mean, do you, like, some couples have a regular weekly date night, or they love to fish, or they travel or something. So,
well, pre-COVID, we did that.
Right. Yeah. Right now, what we're doing, I think our highlight right now is going and taking a walk over to that park. Was it Lila Tatum Park or whatever it is?
Lita Thompson.
Lita Thompson Park. You know, because of the constrictions right now, you know.
I thought you were going to say constructions. Sorry. We do laugh a lot. And that's good. That's good with fun. So we try to get outdoors and do walks and everything. And obviously, before the shutdown, you know, we were able to go out and go
to the movies.
And we like to travel. So yeah. we'd go to India, or we'd go to Myrtle Beach, or we'd travel up to Cape Cod. You know, we love theater and music. Oh, we went to see, so years ago I knew Pete Townsend. He came.
That turned out to be a disaster.
Well, yeah, because we were up very high. But anyway, he got tickets when Pete came to Atlanta. So we went to see that concert. And you took me to, so sometimes we go. There's a lot of traffic. And it's very expensive in Atlanta. So it's hard to kind of get ourselves, now obviously we can't do it.
I think this year has been particularly difficult because of the constrictions of not being able to do what we would usually do. And I joked with Robin when this whole thing started back in February or March.
Mm-hmm.
Heard this online somewhere, somebody on, I don't know where I heard it. They said, when this is all over, there's going to be a lot of
divorces,
a lot of babies. It's going to be one or the other.
Both.
And that struck true,
And I said, I hope we're not having any more babies.
Yeah, right. Now, I hope we don't end up getting divorced.
Yeah.
But I can see, it's a tremendous, it's been a quite a, what do you call it, stressor. On many different levels. I mean, I'm not working, I'm not going out to work like I have for months, and it's driving me nuts. And of course, that taints everything. It's hard not to.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all these different things that we aren't doing that we usually do.
Well, for 20 years, you went every day to Life University and worked.
20 years.
Yeah. And the last.
Well, since March.
6 months.
Since March.
April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. Yeah, so 8 months.
Mm.
He's been working at home.
Mm.
So that makes a big difference.
And this let's see, what is this? November, October, November, December. I'm not working at all. They forced me into a federal medical leave situation because they wanted us to be 50% on campus, eyeball to eyeball to people. And I said, hey guys, I'm in a high risk group. Why can't we just do remote like we were? I said, no, you got to do. So I had to, do the leave thing, and they would not allow me to do any remote either. So, I've been taking up all my sick leave, which is probably good because I never would have used it otherwise. So I've got 3 months. On one level, I'm getting paid vacation, but it's not a vacation.
Because you can't go anywhere.
You can't go anywhere, and it wasn't really my choice.
Yeah.
But it has given me a chance to really say, do I really want to be doing this? It did give me a space to, instead of just bitching and pissing and moaning about, same thing all the time, it's giving me a little perspective, so. I'm ready to go back again. I don't want to, but, they're saying if I don't go back in January, I got to reapply for my job again.
Mm.
And I'm like, we're not going to do that. But for another 6 months, I'm okay with it.
I'll
wear my little ozone ionizer machine. I got my mask,
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Robin, Harville Hendrix, who we both like, says that people pick the familiar, and then they have wounds that complement each other, and the point is to raise that to consciousness, but most people don't. And I'm wondering in your clients what you see as patterns in marriages that aren't working or that are working. What do you see any patterns in terms of people picking the familiar?
Sure. Well, I would put it a little bit of a different way, but I mean, I think it's a similar idea. I think that when you are not conscious, when the process of marriage is not a conscious, intentional process, then our default is being attracted to people who will provide a situation that is an unresolved childhood pattern, whether it's with a father or mother or, you know, another adult caregiver, whatever, and you get to reenact that pattern and work it through. And so people who are unconscious, you know, they'll do that, and then they'll get very upset and angry, mad, whatever, that they're in that situation with the person and all of the stuff that they thought, you know, that they never wanted to have in their life, they're presented with it, having to work it out. When you are in a marriage in a conscious, intentional way, you kind of expect that. So, and we know that it can be either mother or father, it can be, you know, or some other significant caregiver. So that, for example, and I can just tell you how it played out in my life. So I had, in growing up, I had two father figures in my life. I had my biological father and my stepfather, and neither one of them, both of them were angry, had a lot of anger, and neither one of them were nurturing and supportive, and in that regard I felt like I didn't get good enough fathering, although my stepdad was very spiritual, even though he had a very difficult ego and a lot of people didn't like him. But he was really my first spiritual teacher, in the sense that he had a bookcase, and when I was in middle school and high school, I would read all his spiritual books, like Edgar Cayce on reincarnation, and Yogananda, and Krishnamurti, and Kahlil Gibran, and all that. So so I always could talk to him about spiritual things, but the personality wasn't, you know, there. And, you know, I didn't think of it this way, but, you know, my dad was a doctor. My stepdad struggled with his employment situation. So he was kind of on and off. He was a stockbroker, but still he struggled with that. And so I, when Jim and I, well, okay, so my first husband, who was a mentor type.
He was like your stepdad.
Yeah, he was more like my stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jim and I got together, of course, when I met him, he wasn't a doctor. But when we did actually get together as a couple, he was becoming a doctor. So that was my fantasy, that he was going to be, you know, the doctor, the professional person who was going to take care of me, and he wasn't going to be anything like my father, stepfather. So when he would get angry, I would get really scared and I would try to shut him down. This is when we were younger, when I didn't really understand the dynamic. I would try to shut his anger down because I was afraid of it. You know, I was afraid that he was going to, I mean, no one in my life ever really hurt me. You know, they weren't physical. It was just a lot of noise. But, you know, there were other things. There were other situations where I saw things that were potentially could have been dangerous. So in the beginning, that was kind of a contention in our relationship. It was very unconscious. And then at some point, you know, we worked on it in therapy, and we worked on it consciously as well. And I'm much more allowing and accepting of anger, of anybody's anger, and also Jim's anger. I know, you know, although I don't like it when he gets when he's angry and he's telling me about it, it's not usually, he's not angry at me, but it always sounds like he's angry at me. But then we can communicate, and he says, you know, I'm not angry at you. And I will say, okay, but then don't yell at me. I don't like it. But we can talk about it, you know. So there's, you know, there's that. But then there's a lot of ways he's a lot like my mother as well, in personality. And I'm sure that, you know, when you feel sometimes like I'm like your mother, of course, I'm not really like his mother, but and we're talking about the worst parts. Not, you know, you never say, "Oh, honey, you're the best part of my father." You know, you always say, "You're the worst part."
I'm just thinking about when we sit at the table, the dinner table, and our oldest son Josh with his wife Kaylee and their three kids, and we sit there and watch the dynamic, and it, you know. It, to me, it's comical, and it's so obvious that he married his mother on so many levels. You know, I can't help it. It's just like, there it is, you know, because there's so much similarity on so many different ways that it happens, you know.
So that must be a good thing.
It is a good thing.
It is what it is. I don't know, good, bad, ugly, whatever. It's, sometimes it can be a good thing. Sometimes it can be a real problem. Yeah.
Well, but we do have a lot in common. I mean, that's true. I mean, there's a few things that we don't. But, I mean, for example, the way that
the dynamics show up is very similar.
I mean, we all eat organic food, and we all eat, you know, homemade stuff, and we're all, you know, we're all holistic.
I'm talking about personality dynamics.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah.
Well. How does that play out? What are the dynamics with Josh and his wife?
It's just been the way that they interact with each other and what they say and how they say it. And, you know, it sounds awfully familiar.
And Josh is a tease.
Yeah,
so
that's just part of it.
He'll say things, to get to trigger you.
Yeah.
You know, and he does it to everybody, but he does it to me a lot. And
you guys are so much alike, it's insane. And watching his interaction with his wife versus what he did when he was growing up with his mom, it's like, okay, there we go again. There's the tape, you know. And Kaylee reacts very similar to the way you react in some ways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he sets it up unconsciously, and of course she's responding, and you know, that's a whole nother story about her and her family. But it's very comical.
So what does Robin remind you of in terms of your parents? I mean, is there a similar scenario?
You don't like it when I work a lot. Where does that come from?
I'm going to say that it'd be more with my mother, but because I had a lot more interaction with my mother than with my dad, I just didn't have enough material to work with my dad. He was always in the background, and that's not Robin. Robin's not a background person. And there's times when I don't see it so much with me, but when I see her interact with the kids, particularly Josh, because he's next door, sometimes I'll see Gene show up.
It's
but actually, it's more what happens is I'll get into a certain way of being, and Robin will look at me and say, you know, stop it, Gene. Or something like that, because I'm acting like the way my mother would be, right?
Right.
In some kind of a tone. I'm totally unaware of it.
Mm.
Said something, I'm going, shh, you're so good, you know. So just like my mother, oh my God, you know.
I can see your mother and your father in you at different times.
Yeah, but sometimes what happens is when I'm upset about our relationship, there'll be a perception I have I'm not getting this out of it, or I'm not getting that out of it. And I remember talking to Heidi about it, and it hit me really like, wow. I'm talking about my mother, not Robin. You know, because like it was the same a conversation of not being listened to or appreciated or talked, you know, kind of tamped down, don't want to hear you. Like, for instance, one time my mother goes, so how you doing? You know, and I wasn't a particularly, it was a rough day. And I said, oh, you know, this is, I'm not doing really well today. She goes, I don't want to hear that shit.
That's his mother.
And that's it.
I know.
You know, so that kind of internalization that I grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'll be running on a tape, and I remember talking to Heidi one time, who was
Heidi is
a therapist.
Heidi is our energy worker.
And I was talking to her about, you know, this or that. I'm not happy with this with Robin. That, and it just hit me, on, oh, my God, I'm not talking about Robin at all. Mm. You know, I'm talking about my mother, yeah. You know.
Well, what I noticed is when we were younger, and I wasn't working as much as I work now. I was very focused on Jim and his work and the kids and somewhat on mine. I mean, I always had my hand in it, but I wasn't as focused. And as we've gotten older and these last number of years, particularly the last 6 years where I've been doing my doctoral program and my research on top of my business and on top of the kids and on top of everything, I noticed that when I work a lot like that, Jim feels he's not getting enough attention or caring or whatever, even though I feel like I give him a lot. But and I think you felt that way growing up in your family.
Oh yeah,
his parents worked a lot.
My parents worked all the time. It seemed like all the time. And like particularly when we moved from Wichita down to Miami, they had started up another business, and it was like that was their main thing. I was the only child.
Oh.
My brother had moved out when he was 16 and I was 12.
Oh wow.
And so when we moved to Miami, I was effectively an only child.
You were elected
because my brother stayed in the Midwest. He did not move to Miami. And yeah, I was a latchkey kid from then on. And it really did a number, you know, so I didn't like it. And I brought that along. So when she does that, it would bring up all that stuff, you know. But she does have a, you know, somebody says, so how's Robin doing? Well, she's, you know, complaining. Oh, she's complaining. Well, so no, so that's the way she operates. She just piles all this stuff on herself, and then she complains about it. What am I going to do? Oh, my God. This is like this. And it's like, stop doing that, because you're the one that did it. You are the one that have all the choices. You created it. You can undo whatever you want. No, I can't. No. It's like, okay. And I walk away. It's like, done deal, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know. Some of that interaction.
Well, I do take on a lot of things.
You do. Anything else that we've left out that you think people should know entering a commitment, like a marriage?
Oh. What would you tell our children? What did you tell John about?
That story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my parents were in town, and they had just had their 60th wedding anniversary. And as Johnny was walking out the door, he goes, Grandpa, how is it you guys lasted so long? And he goes, Johnny, three magic words. And he goes, what, I love you? And he goes, no. He goes, you're right, dear. It's a joke, but I mean, to a certain extent, there's some truth in that on both sides. Giving, you know,
give a hint to each other.
Compromising.
Yeah. Even when you know that you are right, quote unquote, being able to compromise with grace and, like, you know, seeing the bigger picture.
Well, you know? My grandparents were married for about 70 years. And so I have that history of, you know, of knowing them, my mother's parents, and your parents were married till, you know, they both ended when one of the spouses died, but they were over 65 years, right? It was over. So what happened when we got married, and I'm the oldest child in my family, is we said to my grandfather, my grandmother was deceased at that time, but we said to my grandfather, what is the secret? You know, what should we do? What advice would you give us? You know, it's just getting married. And he thought about it for a minute and he said, take care of each other.
Sweet.
And that was very sweet. And I think that
don't
is
go to bed angry. That was your grandmother.
Yeah. And, you know, and then how does that fit kind of our spiritual beliefs and all that, you know, to not get caught up in the small ego things, you know, to have that clarity that, you know, your partner is on a spiritual path and you're going in the same direction. And you kind of help each other to do that, and not, and if you have a gripe, if you're really, really upset, I mean, not to, that we shouldn't tell each other how we feel, but the if you're going to have a gripe, go to God, you know, go to God so many times throughout our younger years. When he would drive me crazy about something, and I would think, I can't stand it. If something doesn't happen in this regard, I cannot stay in this marriage any longer. And I would pray, and I would say, you know, to Meher Baba, who, you know, is my way of, you know, form of praying, and I would say, look, you know, this is what's going on. I can't stand it. You got to do something. I don't know what you're going to do, but you got to do something. And then the next day or so, Jim would say, you know, I was meditating and it occurred to me. And then he would say something about the exact thing that I was upset about. And he would have some plan or some insight or something that would, you know, move him forward in that area. And it always happens. It always happens. If I handle it the right way, it always happens.
That's beautiful.
So don't blame the other person.
Understand them.
Understand, make them accountable, but don't put, you know, there is a fine line of blame versus accountability, but don't rely on your partner as the ultimate one who's going to keep the thing going. I think the ultimate source is that internal higher power, you know.
Yeah.
And then just keep going with it. You know?
You said you had an energy worker who is kind of a therapist that you've had as a resource.
She's a nurse practitioner, and she's an energy worker.
Medical intuitive.
Medical intuitive, but she's an energy worker, and she does online sessions. And her name is Heidi Jost, J-O-S-T.
Lives in Chicago.
She's outside of Chicago. She has a website. She does, I've never met her face-to-face, but I know that she does some very interesting massage work with women and pelvic floor issues. But as I say, we've not met her face-to-face, only online. But she's really intuitive, and she can see a lot of things, and then she actually can do energy work. But I mean, you have to work on the emotions as well. So you can't just be doing energy work. You have to, you know, work on all levels as well. You have to work on the childhood issues and the knots that are in the field and traumas and whatever, all those things.
Right. Where will you go for your next vacation when COVID is done with?
Well, it depends on the time of the year. If it's June or July, we'll go up to Cape Cod where my grandmother, well, you don't know, but my grandmother was an artist, and in the 40s, the New York artist would always go up to Cape Cod, Provincetown, Wellfleet, Truro, to paint. So my grandfather, you know, built a house, and they would go up every summer. My mother goes there, and she's just turning 90, I dare say. She's going to kill me. But
there's three places.
And then India.
Cape Cod.
Oh.
India.
And Myrtle Beach.
One of those three is usually where we go.
Yes.
We've got a house in Cape Cod. No, we have a house in Myrtle Beach, house in India, and her mother has a place, you know, in Cape Cod.
In Cape Cod.
So that's nice. Pretty much, yeah.
Nice. I love India because it's so colorful.
Yes.
It's like a feast for your eyes every minute.
It is. And smells.
It's just
it's a feast for your eyes and feast for your nose.
It's got everything.
Yeah. Thank you. I am